Success Leaves Clues podcast with Robin Bailey and Al McDonald. Have you ever wondered what makes someone successful? What are they doing that's different? How do they achieve greatness? We believe that success leaves clues. In this series, we are interviewing very successful people from different walks of life to hear their stories. We'd like to remind our listeners that the views expressed in this podcast are those of our guests and not necessarily those shared by our hosts. Today's episode is sponsored by Life and Legacy Advisory Group. Discover our commitment to our clients. At Life and Legacy, building wealth, securing your family's future, giving back, and creating a lasting legacy are not just values, but a way of life. Let us guide you toward a future aligned with what matters most to you. We're also brought to you by Aria Benefits. If you're a business leader challenged with talent attraction, employee engagement, or supporting mental health, we can help. Use your benefits package as the key to unlock your workforce. Now here's your hosts, Robin Bailey and Al McDonald.
Welcome back to Success Leaves Clues. Today's episode is a little bit different, and honestly, one we've been waiting to do for a very long time. We're talking about one of the most persistent and emotionally charged topics in people leadership right now: return to work versus remote work. And more importantly, what this debate says about trust, accountability, and how organizations actually get results. This isn't going to be a hot take episode. It's a practitioner conversation with people who are living this every day. I'm going to act more as a facilitator today. I'll tee up a question and we'll move around the table to get different perspectives. There's no right answer here, just lived experience. So where I thought we'd start with this panel is, why don't we start with some quick intros like name, role, and the lens you bring into this conversation. And Amanda, why don't we start with you?
Hi, thanks for having me, Robin. My name is Amanda Small and I'm the head of people and culture for Canada for Object Way Financial Solutions, previously Nest Wealth Asset Management. I've been in people and culture for 11 years now, probably going on 12 years now. And I think the lens that I bring is that our job as people practitioners is to really cultivate the organism of culture and the organism of people. And the way that we do that, I think, best is by really taking a lens of empathy, of understanding, of consideration. And that's why I'm so interested to have this conversation, because we're always navigating the tension of how do we kind of feed the organism in the way we want to have it grow and be really intentional and conscientious about that. So I think this is a really relevant topic when we think about that. I'm excited to be here.
Thanks, Amanda.
Yeah.
And Karis, you want to go next?
Likewise, so excited to tackle this topic. A little bit different from Amanda and Elizabeth's background, I come from the operations side of life, and a few companies ago had the opportunity to work with Innerspace, which analyzes how people move inside buildings. And so we're talking about culture, we're talking about return to work, but the physical space has to support that. And the decisions around how your business operates needs to work in tandem with that. And when we're talking about a five generation in office or in company paradigm that we're in now, so many factors are coming to the stage and are relevant to the conversation. And so very excited to dive in today.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you're here. Elizabeth.
Absolutely. I'm excited to be here too. I'm Elizabeth Lynch. I'm an HR consultant with my firm Engage Leadership Consulting. I help CEOs drive high performance cultures and high performance companies throughout the US and Canada. So I'm really excited to be here today because I have clients who do everything. And my lens is really that employee engagement and strong culture teams drives and has direct results on the performance of the company, and getting it right through having the right workspace in whatever manner that that company sees fit is essential to drive performance.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us, Elizabeth. And you might recognize our final panelist. His voice, you might have heard on the podcast once or twice, but Al, let's go over to you.
Well, yes, usually I'm on the other side of the table and I'm the one asking the question. So I don't mind saying at all that being on the other side of the table is actually feeling quite uncomfortable. And I also don't mind saying that I feel totally outgunned sitting here. And I did question before even why I'm being here, and I'm being honest. So interested as how this conversation will go. So there you go.
Well, thank you, Al. And it's always a pleasure to do a podcast with you. We do a lot of them. Of course, I'm your host, Robin Bailey. I will say a special thanks to Amanda and Karis, because it was over lunch, one of our wonderful lunches that we do together. Amanda had said, hey, Karis and I had this idea about, you know, in this series, hopefully, that we turn into. And that's where this all came from. So at the end, we'd love to hear your feedback. And if there's a desire for more of these conversations, certainly we'd love to be able to do that for you. So where I thought we'd start, and maybe we can start with Elizabeth and go around the table. At its core, Elizabeth, do you see the return to work debate as a location issue, or is it more of a trust and accountability issue? So we'll start with Elizabeth.
That's a great question. So I think it's been incredible to watch since COVID how this return to work situation is going to play out. I was on your podcast a few years ago, and I said, I don't think you can put the toothpaste back in the toothpaste container. Like, once you let people leave the office, I'm not sure there's coming back. But we're seeing a lot of this push. And I think that the strive behind it a lot is the locations and the buildings and the investments companies make, but also that idea of trust. It is very difficult to manage people. And it is essential that our managers know how to manage, and they spent a long time learning how to manage in office. And then all of a sudden the rug was pulled out and everyone wasn't in office. And we have to learn how to manage that way. And I think a lot of organizations have struggled in how to create purposeful and the right type of management to drive performance. And it's easier, in their opinions, to do it in office because that's how they've known it before. So I think from that lens, we see a lack of trust that does bring people pushing that debate of maybe we should go back to the office because I feel like I can trust them more if I can see what they're doing.
Well, Elizabeth, you bring up some good points, and one that just made me think of an appointment I did, I guess maybe just at the very beginning of the pandemic. And I used to drive into Toronto and park under City Hall, and notorious for getting lost in City Hall, because if you've ever parked underground, they have squirrel and deer and all these sections. It's a massive parking lot. And I remember it being quite eerie driving in there and there's no cars. And I got a parking spot on the level one, and then walking down the street and again, not seeing very many people. And then going into a client's office that usually had 200 people and no one was there. So there's all these empty spaces that we had to consider, and rents that had been entered just at the perfect time when COVID hit and everybody was sent home. So I think that's a really interesting perspective. Amanda,
yeah.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, I think, I mean, what we're really kind of teasing at here when we say trust, I think of accountability. I think what happens with something that Elizabeth is kind of pointing to is, what do we mean when we say accountability? Because visibility does not equal accountability. Seeing someone doesn't make them accountable. But what does make people accountable is having really transparent and clear outcomes in terms of what does good look like? What is success? If accountability is actually tied to results, then visibility becomes less of a crutch, I guess I would say. So I think when we're really talking about return to office and mandating return to office, I think where we're seeing leaders and managers struggle and suffer, even myself struggle and suffer during COVID, is how do we clearly articulate what good looks like, what success means, that we have very clear focus on the high urgency, high important things, and we're not having people just sort of do everything, but also sort of tie up that if we could see them, then we'd know they were doing the right work or the most important work or being accountable. So I think teasing that out and really starting to understand where are leaders and managers struggling to really provide clear and total transparency for their people so that it becomes less charged whether I see your bum in a seat working 8 hours a day, because we already know that seeing bums in seats doesn't mean successful outcomes for the business. It means you see bums in seats. Now, I'm also not saying having everyone remote sees successful business outcomes. Successful businesses have wildly clear and kind of surgical focus on their success metrics, and what that good outcome looks like. And they're able to translate that out to their people and manage for outcomes, manage to outcomes, and manage people towards outcomes rather than what I call managing people, right? Like, managing people just there, but really looking for, you know, kind of honing our ability. Listen, remote managing is tough. But, you know, in-person managing is also tough. So just really kind of trying to distill, what is that tension? What is that when we say, is return to office based on trust and accountability? I think it's mostly, do we actually even know why we really want people in the office? And if we can articulate the value of that and then really create an environment where that value is absolutely understood. And by the way, I've not heard anyone say they've done that successfully by making people come back into the office. Then I think you'll see people who actually are happy to come into the office or happy to be in hybrid work. But if we can't do that, I think then we start to get into that ground being like, but why am I here? And managers being like, I'm not seeing the outcomes that I thought I would, even though people are in the office. And maybe you're even starting to see, you know, employees becoming disgruntled and frustrated and disengaged. So
when you're talking about bums and seats, it reminds me of a conversation that Al and I had yesterday. And we thought, okay, we're doing all the right things. We've returned to a hybrid, you know, 3 days a week, and that seems to be working well for our office. Yeah. And we had decided on Tuesdays as partners, our huddle would be in person because reviewing our week and all the things we're trying to accomplish. And that's great. So we did that. And then the other 2 days a week where I'd be sitting in my office downstairs and Al would be sitting in his office upstairs and my business partner beside us, and we'd be all on our screens.
Yeah.
And I thought, why are we coming into the office to sit, to be on our screens? And our decision was, if we're in the office, we're going to go in our boardroom and sit together and, yeah, you know, be in front of each other at least. But it brings up such interesting things about exactly what we're talking about today. Karis, I'm going to go over to you for your perspective because I'd love to hear your angle on this.
Well, I love that this is a multi-layered cake that we're starting to bake, which is you have this operational level that Amanda's talking about, where you need to have clear goals, a clear pathway to measure and produce against those goals. Elizabeth is talking about trust and what that looks like. And I'd venture to add that how we're defining trust across generations has fundamentally changed. And over the last 20, 30 years with the advance of technology, social media, bring your own device to work, all of the technology that's supporting this has also changed. Right. So you have senior leaders who are not digital natives. How they built trust outside of management style was on face-to-face, deep-rooted communications. It was, I can look you in the eye, I can have a handshake before a contract, and that's how I'm going to get business done. Right? Those are our leaders now. Mm-hmm. You know, we're Gen X, you know, you've got your boomers as well. The younger generation who is digital native, that is not how they've built trust. They have built trust based on their values, based on doing good in the world. The handshake and the looking each other in the eye is not a factor for them. Mm. And so what we're also talking about is a psychology around trust. So the definition of trust and how we build it, that's not even consistent. So this one size fits all to coming back to the office, to thinking that the ROI for the senior leader or the ROI on that office for a younger member on your team, we're not even measuring by the same yardstick anymore. And so to just say, come back to the office, whether it's 1 day or 5 days, to have an outcome that we shared, I think is the fundamental problem of why this isn't working for people.
Yeah. Well, Al, now I know you might sit the furthest on the side of returning to work. Maybe you'll surprise us today. I don't know. But I've known you for a few years, so, and I think you're leaning that way. But what's your take here?
Listen, I can't add anything better than what I've already heard. We're going to get to a point where I'm going to share some stuff with you and with everyone that's here, but it's not now.
Fair.
So love their answers. By the way, I do love, hey, you know, you can't squeeze the toothpaste back into the tube. And I love the analogy of the multi-layered cake. It's great.
All right, Amanda, I am coming to you to start our next one.
Okay.
Because I think it's a really interesting question. So how much choice do you believe employees should have realistically in how they work? And where do leaders need to draw a line? Because, you know, during the pandemic, I had clients that said their IT would come to them and say, hey, did you know this person was working halfway around the world? Because they thought remote was remote.
Yeah.
Right? So realistically, how much say do they get? And where do you say, well, no, you've got to have some guardrails around that.
Yeah. Karis has an amazing saying about this, and I'm not going to say it because I want her to share it. I've been using it all the time, though, now that she has shared it. But here's what I would say. I actually believe that flexibility We know that it does improve retention, engagement, people's feeling of well-being. And one of the things I was going to mention is that the Women in the Workplace study, like a huge study by Leenan and McKinsey, basically says that women particularly, or caregivers, right, they count on flexibility in order to be able to manage their lives and also continue to be part of the workforce in a meaningful way while they have lots of caregiving and other duties. I'm not saying it's only women, but the study focuses on women, and we know women tend to be caregivers. So listening to your workforce, I think, is really important. But Karis, I think she makes a really good point, and I don't want to steal her thunder, but the idea of being able to listen, but also not cater necessarily, you're taking in information and taking people's perspectives, really listening to your employees about what matters to them, but not catering to every single request. You know, everyone can't be working out of the country or being digital nomads all the time, things like that, but really listening for what matters to them, and then trying to create a plan where we are considerate of people's needs, but we're not, you know, catering to every single individual outcome. We're really sort of taking, okay, here are the things we can provide in terms of flexibility. I think having a hybrid or anchor day kind of return to office, if you do feel that it's important to be together for certain things, articulate that and then listen. If the majority of people are saying 2 days really works for me, I'm going to be 4 hours commuting in and out because I bought a house in Barrie because that's where I could afford a home. We don't want to say come in every day to sit on a screen in virtual meetings. My team is distributed across Europe now in Canada. My entire morning this morning, 9 until 2 p.m. till we joined, was in meetings with people across the globe, right? And so there isn't, even on Wednesday when I was in the office, I spent all my time on the screen. And so all that is to say, if they had asked me, what's more comfortable for you, doing that every day in the office or doing that 1 or 2 days a week, and sort of deciding intentionally what our cadence and sequences for working together in the office, why we're in the office working together, what do we want to get done? Are those days virtual meeting free so we can have lots of in-person brainstorming and collaborative work? You know, really, I think designing intentionally becomes wildly important for creating a workplace where people actually, you get their buy-in around it. But we're not going to do, every person gets to say, I think you need to take inputs and then make a plan from that, but we can't. Karis, I want you to take it away and say your thing.
Before Daris does, because I'm going to Karis next, obviously, because now we want to hear what this is. But I want to push back on that a little bit, because from your experience, and Karis, maybe you can answer this as well, to listen to your employees, like, that sounds very good to me. Like, let's listen to the employees and do the things that are most important to them where it's possible for our business. But I'm worried about the person that isn't going to say anything. And then if they think this is just the way it is, and then I'm going to quietly leave. How do you deal with those people that say, well, it's 3 days a week for these guys, I'm not going to bother saying anything, I'm just going to find somewhere where it is 100% remote because that's what I want to do. Like, how do you address that?
I would be so curious why they feel like, what are the mechanisms for taking input that they feel they can't give anonymous input where you're actually, they don't have to go to Al and be like, only because, Al, I know you appreciate people being together in the office. Also, too, going to any founder, leader, executive in the company, most people don't feel 100% comfortable doing that. So I think just kind of thinking about, how are you getting some of those inputs and how are you taking data from your employees and actually creating a plan with data instead of this person wants this, like, individual input. I think you have to kind of look at the collective and really start to make some plans around what does that look like if we really kind of, again, take that phrase, what does good look like when we take all of this data from our employees? I mean, we can't guarantee people are going to tell us things, but I know they won't tell me to my face. So we do a lot of anonymous surveying. I mean, that's how we actually get our data because we know people, they don't want to they don't want to say something that they think might come back around to them specifically.
I'm glad you said that about the anonymity, yeah, because I think that's really important. And that's where you are going to get that feedback. And it's interesting because we did a recent survey that Elizabeth would be aware of. And it was really, I'm not sure the word I'm looking for, maybe it's encouraging. Mm-hmm. And I think it speaks to, you know, we're approachable. Someone had come back and you didn't have to put your name, but they said, hey, here's what's really important to me. And they actually put their name down.
Yeah.
And then we were able to go and have a conversation and we were able to accomplish one of the things that was really important to them. So I thought, that's really great. Karis, I can't wait to hear now because I'm in suspense here. So let's go over to you next.
Well, I certainly can't take full credit for the coining of the phrase. But I think before we get into that, we're talking about a tension point that we all love to ignore, which is work is simply an agreement for the exchange of work and money. Mm-hmm. And I think we sometimes forget we want to be inclusive. We want to create equitable workspaces, but that doesn't mean equal. And as a business owner, you have a responsibility that is different than the employee who is producing work. When we talk about return to office, there are some fundamentals. No, you cannot go work in another country. There are tax laws that I have to abide by. No, you can't go work in another country because we are a bank and we have security requirements that we must uphold. Those are very reasonable boundaries around which you will create your remote work policy. That said, when we talk about, well, I have one employee who wants to make a case to go work somewhere else. Gary Vee has this fantastic video, go Google it, where he simply says, that is wonderful. Please go find that place to go work. Mm-hmm. You have choice, and it is not my responsibility as a business owner or a business leader to create the ideal space for every individual. And so that gets to this coining of the phrase. It was actually created by my friend Erin Mills. She's a dietitian. And one of the things that she does is work with parents to help them teach really great eating behaviors with children. And so one of the theories that she has for parents, and so dropping it here for any parents who are listening, is this idea of being considerate without catering. Mm. You don't want to be a short order chef in your kitchen every day for your family. So perhaps you're making quesadillas for you and the family. Maybe you're making a deconstructed quesadilla that your child can pick the ingredients that they want, but you're not making also fries and chicken fingers and soup and everything else that's going on. You're not a short order chef. So you're being considerate of your family, but you're not catering to your family. Mm. And I loved that phrase because when I was at Vetster and we were designing our policy from remote work, flex work, but also our benefits and what we were going to bring to the table, we wanted to be best in class. We wanted to really attract and retain talent. But we knew we can't make it for everybody. Some people need dental coverage. Other people wanted mental health. Some people needed more flexibility in when they would come to the office. Some people loved being in the office, and that was amazing. So we took a considerate without catering approach, which was we want to be best in class. I hope you love 80% of this. Mm-hmm. But I am also going to have a boundary, which is I'm not going to listen to the complaints about the 20% that each individual doesn't like and doesn't work for them. Does 80% of this meet the mark for you? Awesome. Are you mad that somebody else gets to put braces on their kids because that doesn't work for you because you don't have children? That's not a complaint that's acceptable. I love to call that's for your girlfriends and red wine conversation. That's not appropriate in the workplace. Mm-hmm. But I think we also as business leaders and employees have a responsibility to understand what that looks like. Am I getting enough? If I'm not, I have an opportunity to talk to leadership about what change might look like. However, if it's really important to me, maybe I also need to look for somewhere else that can give that to me.
It's a better fit. Yeah.
I love that. And I'm going to be Googling that Gary Vee video after this because now I want to see that.
Also, what a great phrase. Consider it without catering. It's perfect, Karis.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that really is.
Thank Erin. Yeah. She really nailed it.
You care.
Well, Elizabeth, I'm curious to hear your take on this one.
Yeah. I think Karis nailed it on the head because employees do have a choice. And one of those choices is leaving the organization. I think where organizations struggle is when they haven't created a purposeful plan and then laid down what that plan is. In researching where companies have really been successful in getting people back to the office, I've saw a lot of data on the ones that said, okay, here's where we are. We're 3 days or 4 days a week in the office. And here's your chance to leave if you don't want to do that, I think is an important statement as well. You don't have to work here. If you're going to be miserable because we are fully at home or fully in the office, or you need to do 3 days instead of 2 days, there are options, right? And so I don't think it's the organization's duty to try to make it work for everyone. I think it's an organization's duty to be very purposeful on what is right for that organization and do take into consideration their employees' needs, you know, being considerate without catering, and then set the line down and say, this is who we are and this is why. You can take us or leave us. One of the things I love about Zappos, which I always studied their culture when Tony Hsieh was there, because they did amazing things, is after they onboarded their employees and got them used to their core values, they actually offered separation pay for their employees to leave. Yeah. Because they wanted you to be so diehard. I agree with the company and I agree with the core values. I'm going to stay. If you don't want to stay, you don't have to. Here is a package. And I think it's to be that clean cut helps employees. Because for me to feel like there's some wiggle room, so I'm going to keep fighting for that extra day and now I'm going to be disgruntled, sometimes we need to give permission to leave if this isn't what you want it to be.
I like that. Yeah, I really like that. Al, anything to add on this one?
Yeah. I want to dive into a couple things.
Right.
This is where we start to go down the rabbit hole.
Take us down, Al.
So, Karis, you said one thing. So I'm going to ask about something you said, and I'm going to ask about something that Amanda said. Elizabeth, you're off the hook for now. How about that? Karis, you said something about what work is. Mm-hmm. Can you say that again?
I think we have to recognize it's like the unspoken truth that we don't talk about, which is work is an exchange for effort, outcome, for money. And it is the responsibility of the leadership to define what that is. If you don't want to earn money in that way, and I agree with Elizabeth, absolutely. We want to create cultures and spaces that are safe, that are amazing, you know, productive, where people are advancing their careers. So I don't want to dismiss that. This isn't a puritanical view of what work should be. But we also need to acknowledge on both sides, there's an exchange here that is happening because it is called business, not charity. This isn't high school. This isn't a community. This is an exchange of work. And so how that work is going to get done, at what cost and at what pay, is a conversation and agreement that is omnipresent and constantly being renegotiated in very small ways as somebody is developing their career.
Okay. I hope in my heart of hearts that work is much more than that. Mm. Because when I get to the point where work is nothing but I give you effort and I get money back, I'm out of the game. To me, work is much more than that. And I think I've said this before and I'll say it again. I don't love my work. I don't wake up every morning and like hop out of bed and go, hey, what another great day because I get to go to work. I don't. But I enjoy my work. Mm-hmm. And I think, I hope that I'm not just doing it. And I hope other people aren't too, just for, hey, I put in my effort and I get my money back.
I'd like to clarify, though, I agree. I absolutely agree. I'm not saying that the exchange of commerce is the thing. But I think we have to agree when we're talking about how we're designing our culture, you're passionate about what you do. But if the construct of the organization became untenable to what you personally want, we have to acknowledge that you can go and earn money somewhere else and hopefully get the things that you want. Because again, your perspective may be different from Robin's, may be different from mine. And if we all show up into an organization that maybe only makes Robin happy, and you and I are sitting there thinking, this just isn't for us. I wish we had a better benefits program. I wish we were in the office 5 days a week. I don't like the technology that we're using. I find it difficult to get decisions done in the way that I work. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's an opportunity to help create that change, but ultimately there is also a choice of the employer and a choice of the employee to find what lights them up. And I agree with you, it is more than money. Of course it's more than money. I think all of us on this call, we show up with such passion and we want to change the world and we want to benefit the people around us. Absolutely. But we're not walking into an organization and saying, you know what, don't pay me. I'm just here to hang out. None of us are doing that either. Mm-hmm.
Agreed. Thank you for that. But I'm glad I asked, because I think we're saying the same thing and thinking the same thoughts, maybe just didn't articulate it in the same way that, you know, I was thinking in my head. So, okay, so I do want to go back to something Amanda said too.
Okay.
And this came up a couple of times. I heard a couple of times the word cater, right? We don't need to cater to every. So I will say this. I feel quite often that's exactly what I or we are doing. And it's because like someone says something and like, you don't, you use the example already of, okay, maybe I need to pick up my kids from school. Okay. I get it. Listen, I've been there.
Yeah.
I totally understand. Okay. I've got some medical issues. Okay. I get it. I understand. I've been there. I'm sure we all have. I can continue to go down the list. And every time that someone brings up something and it's valid, and I've probably been there myself, but to go back to the word cater, sometimes that's exactly what it feels like I have to do or we have to do is, okay, we've got to address that need or we've got to address that want or we've got to address the wish that people have come to us. So I don't even know what my question is here, but when you said cater.
How much is too much? Yeah. It sounds like you're asking like kind of where is the line? Like, where are we drawing the line? And I think Karis actually already said something that's really standing out for me, which is I believe deeply in taking a lot of input, and I rely on employee feedback and data to surface themes that are important to employees, but it's not a vote. What's surfacing is a consideration, actually. And then our job, I think where it gets into that place where you're like, ugh, I'm catering, or maybe you're not even frustrated, but you're actually doing different things for different people as they come to you and say, I need this accommodation or I need this flexibility. I think if we go back to what Karis is saying and also what I said in my sort of previous segment, which is our job is to actually have already been intentional in our design of what we want. What do we even mean when we say hybrid or flexible work? I mean, I think you got to get down to brass tacks on when we say return to office, when we say hybrid, when we say flexible, when we say, you know, in our job posting, it says we want you to be able to take care of your life. What does that mean? And if we haven't really defined, aligned, and designed, I didn't even mean for that to rhyme, but if we haven't done those things, that's where you start to get into that, ugh, it's ad hoc. And that does become, hey, I'm making quesadillas tonight. Okay, no problem. I'll also make you some black bean soup and french fries, you know? Because you haven't really said, actually, the meal plan this week is this because we're going to try to hit these 16 vitamins this week. And we clearly know that to hit these 16 vitamins, we're going to do these things. We hope you like 80% of the menu I've prepared, so that you get 80% of the vitamins I'd like you to get. But we're not going to make you black bean soup and french fries. But we've out front, before disappointment, before disengagement, before employee erosion of trust kicks in, we've articulated that intentionally designed and defined, what is it for us to have flexible work? What do we mean? What does it look like? What can you count on us for? What do we expect out of you? And I think we just don't do a good job articulating that. One is because we don't slow down enough to do it, right? COVID sort of thrust us all into remote work. And when our businesses did not fall down, many actually thrived, some did, but many thrived. And we actually saw, oh, fully remote work, people are still delivering, they're doing their work, et cetera. I think there were some connection issues that, you know, people definitely felt. But when we saw that work after the pandemic was over, it took a while for people to even say return to office. And then once we did, I don't think we slowed down to say, what do we really want that to look like? What do we mean when we say it? How do we want people to feel about coming back to work? You know, it's kind of like we want people to come back so we can create connected culture, reinvigorate culture. But what we're actually seeing is people are returning to office in some cases. I think Karis might have some better data on this than just me anecdotally sharing. But also from the Women in the Workplace study, we know return to office for some people is creating lots of disengagement because they're sitting in a desk. Maybe they're in an open concept office where it's super loud. They're on a screen the whole time. You know, in some cases, because some government return to office mandates, I've heard they don't have desks. You can't even book a desk. So we needed to really work that back to leadership, to being those creators of what work with us looks like, being the designers, the creatives, and the strategists, saying we really were putting our beliefs, our values, our operational strategies behind this design, and we're doing it intentionally, and we're sharing that up front. And then I think the employee does have to decide, does that work enough for me? But after being really intentional about that, I think Karis just said that we don't have to listen. It's not a valid complaint if we've done a really good job communicating and articulating ahead of time.
I would add to that as well, when we're thinking about our idea principles, Al, there will always be exceptions because we are going to look at our humans. And somebody may be better served to be fully remote. I know in my past, I've had people who were on the spectrum. Being overstimulated in an office was highly disruptive to their work and to them and their mental health. Of course, we worked with that human being. They were incredible at what they did. There was going to be an exception. But you can't run a business based on exceptions. And we have to remember that equity is not the same as being equal. And what you're really going for is equity. And again, that's the considerate, not catering. What works for some people is a variation of what will work for somebody else. We've long known, one of my first clients over 20 years ago was TELUS. And I got to work on their B2B side of the business. And this was working with this fantastic expert named Mark Lang. I hope we'll be able to introduce him to the listeners at some point, because he was all about mobile work. And this was back in the day, we're talking early days of BlackBerry.
Yeah.
So your phone was given to you. Only certain people got a phone as part of their work. And this was the early days of how can we help people to work from home or work remotely as needed? How can we attract talent that maybe isn't in the center of our city core? How do we think about our business on a global scale, which was really taking off in the advent of social media and the internet? The culture of our society, but also work, was changing. This isn't a new conversation, but what's happened after the other side of pandemic is we now have people with huge real estate portfolios. I heard an investor once say to me in a board meeting, I would like an ROI on person per square foot, which used to be how real estate teams would understand how many people they could put into a space. And now it's been adopted by investors saying, no, 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 I need to max out exactly what you're paying in your lease or your real estate holdings. That doesn't resonate for an employee. And so it's a really interesting cycle that we're in. The pendulum is constantly moving. I think this is where, as people leaders, we need to help people navigate that change. Take the temperature down just a little bit. Recognize that a one-size-fits-all plan is not going to work. It doesn't work across any part of our business. But what is fascinating, and I asked the Innerspace team to dig into some of the data, because this is what they're measuring all day long. For their companies where a return-to-office mandate exists, only 41% of people are coming in. They're coming in mostly for lunch. So they're coming in for that engagement. They're not coming in to do their work. You know, and they're finding ways to now almost create a bit of a subculture around work that isn't what people who are designing these systems are thinking about. And so it's a fascinating opportunity to really get that listening that Amanda and Elizabeth are talking about, thinking about that strategy. You've got to measure it. And ultimately, as we've seen, especially in the last 6 years, you have to be able to evolve. I'd be really curious what Elizabeth is now seeing as she's working with her leaders, if that's resonating.
I'm seeing kind of what everyone has been hinting at, which is that intentionality is what matters. And that lack of intentionality is where we're seeing everything fall apart, right? You talk about people going in for lunch. I hear all the time about the coffee badging. Like, if a company is measuring you by if you badge in or not, to me, that's not the right metric if returned office is working. But that's how a lot of large organizations are measuring it. So they badge, they get the cup of coffee, and then they go back home, right? I think that, you know, we're still very stuck in slowing down and creating the intentionality stage. And so we're seeing such a diversity of success in every mechanism because of that lack of intentionality in many cases.
It's so fascinating, though, the work around culture. Oh. I mean, pulling some data from just our natural tendency as humans, you know, I see it in my kids all the time. They find the most creative workarounds. And I think there's kind of something, I think there's some really important information that we can get from if you are saying, badging in is how we're going to know you're doing what we told you to do. It brings me right back to the first thing I said. Do we actually know, and can we say what good looks like?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Because if we're, as leaders, very clear on exactly what needs to get done, and not just clear, but we can say it, articulate it, and coach for it, like we're actually able to be like, here's what I need to see in order to know these critical things are moving forward, we would not even care about badging in and out.
Right.
We would be working fulfilled, doing the most important high urgency things, high importance, high urgency thing, top left box. And I think it's so interesting. I actually want to hear from Robin and Al on this because you are leaders at your company. Mm-hmm. And do you find, even in non-return to office, when we were all in office, this was also a challenge for leaders and management, right? To really be able to engage people on the most important things and measure accountability that way, measure success through, are we doing the things that actually move our business forward? Or are we kind of all swirling around doing all kinds of things? You know, it's not that people aren't busy. I think people are often really working, but are they working on the most important thing? Are we even clear on what that is?
It's always true. Yeah.
Hey, Amanda.
Yeah.
And this is a question, it can be for yourself or it can be for anyone who has an example on the panel. Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples of where you've seen autonomy improve outcomes? And maybe on the flip side, where that's backfired?
Do you mean autonomy working remotely?
Yeah. Yeah. Having the freedom to say, well, I'm in the office, I'm over here. That sort of thing. Here's how I'm going to work. Because I think you talked about earlier on when you were first speaking, you were saying about the pandemic hit, we had thrust into to remote work and a lot of companies thrived and they realized, oh, we can still move the needle forward, right? But maybe some other examples of maybe where it backfired. So this can be for anyone on the panel if they have any examples of that.
Define improve and define success. For who? The company or the individual or both?
Very good question.
Yeah. I think there are two areas I would answer this in. One thing that going remote forced us to do was to be a lot better at being transparent with our MBRs and QBRs, like these weekly, monthly, and quarterly meetings and goal setting. So we sort of created a lot more operational rigor, people, programs, and processes across the company that looked different. And I think the rigor was there because we weren't just around each other kind of organically like, oh, yeah, did you close that deal? You know, we actually had to build in, and we used an OKR system, and I'm not promoting that, but we built in a cadence, an operational rigor around our cadence and our transparency of what we were doing. We reported every month to each other, you know, in an all hands. And I think one of the things that we saw was that if you asked anyone, it could be in engineering, it could be in customer success, professional services, you name it, they knew the most important things the company needed to do. And I don't think this is something that happened just because we were remote, but we built some rigor around that because we couldn't just talk about it organically kind of around the office. So that was one thing that happened. I also think once we went remote, we intentionally decided to have a weekly, actually it was a twice weekly company-wide stand-up that was just joyful sharing. We told jokes, we celebrated people's birthdays, And it was called The Daily, but we only did it twice a week. But it was called The Daily, and everyone would join, and we rotated through the entire company. If it was your day, we had a rotation list. You opened up the meeting with the dad joke of the day. And we loved these dad jokes. I mean, this became like the anchor of our 2.5 years fully remote. So that's one thing that happened. We actually saw, I wouldn't say better, but deeper engagement by just being forced into that operational rigor and to kind of be more intentional and dedicated to how are we sharing information since it's not going to organically pass around the way it was. And that wasn't working super well. So we delivered better during that time. We closed our largest deals during the pandemic. You know, we just had this, I think, kind of unified force, and it made us all learn the OKR system and use it, deploy it. And again, I'm not saying it's the perfect system, but it was a system that ended up working for us. From a people perspective, because we do twice a year employee engagement surveys, the amount that people shared that it made such a huge difference, two things, to know exactly the most important things to get done for the business and how they contributed to moving that needle, and that they were people in the MBRs or QBRs, our employees, it wasn't always leaders who presented. We would ask our team members, hey, can you present at this month's MBR on the status of, I'll use my team as an example, talent acquisition, how we're doing in hiring. Let's talk about the key roles we fill. Let's talk about our time to close, you know, our metrics that matter. And then they started to build this connection to and ownership of, I'm presenting next month. Like, I'm going for it to, you know, 100 people. I'm going to be on the full screen, like presenting these metrics. And people really enjoyed that. I think it created a lot more ownership for them. But in our employee engagement surveys, people shared what a huge difference it made to be able to start preparing dinner at home while doing their work, bringing their computer down. I mean, we'd have calls, executive leadership team calls, and we would all have our computers in the kitchen and we would talk about what we're cooking in the middle of our meetings, but we're in the meetings. And I think it's not that I think that's a perfect system, but I do really believe that there's just an opportunity to allow greatness to be there if you really take this, I mean, I feel like we're a bit of a broken record here, but really take this approach of how do we want it to look? Like if we said in 1 year, we want to transform these things that right now we don't feel like we have a lot of operational excellence around, or we don't have a lot of engagement around, or we don't see whatever sales targets or revenue targets being hit, how would we do it? I do think people would say, and I know they say it today for sure, those couple of years when we first went remote, I think because we didn't see our deliverables suffering, because we had better client outcomes rather than worse client outcomes. And trust me, we were preparing for worse outcomes. It really created this sense of like, we can do this, but we needed to build in those touch points and cadences that made people still feel that they weren't just on an island in their house doing nothing, while also giving them, for the first time in their entire working life, the opportunity to have flexibility to take care of things that normally would be, you know, just a total crush and crunch to get done. So I'm not sure if I answered your question. I kind of meandered.
You know, you absolutely did. And I'm thoroughly enjoying this conversation. I think, thank goodness you gave us this idea, because I'm learning so much for myself in this conversation, just with your different perspectives. What I'm realizing, though, is we are going to have to do a part two.
Yes, we told you, Robin.
Well, this is going to be part one, just because I don't want the audience listening to a 3-hour podcast, because I will listen to a 3-hour podcast, not everybody will. So we're going to break this down into a couple. But before we go, I do want to cover one more topic and go around the room. And then for the rest, we'll come back and we'll record episode number two. This is going to be a great series that people are going to be able to listen to. I want to change gears a little bit and talk about performance. And Al, this time I'm going to come to you first. So the question is, in your experience, what actually drives performance, Al? Is it visibility, like bums and seats, as Amanda said earlier? Is it outcomes, or is it something else entirely?
Interesting. You know, one of the reasons I didn't weigh in on question one too much was, I think the topic was around trust. And if I have to have, as you say, bums in seats in order to see that people are getting their work done and to trust them, then I think my opinion is I hired the wrong people. So that's why I didn't really weigh in on that much because, yeah, I don't think we've had an example of someone working at home where they just did a lousy job because they're working at home, right? I think from my perspective, I trust people to do their job no matter where they are. And sorry, I'm not quite getting to your question yet, but it came up in the last conversation. Okay, well, real estate, you know, we need people in bums and seats because we've got a building.
Yeah.
And we got to make that building pay. Well, guess what? We got a building. And again, that is the least of my worries. I don't know how that is a driver for people to be in the office. So to get back to your question, I just think it's tough to know the metrics. Elizabeth and I sit on scorecards all the time, as do you. And, you know, are you doing a good job? Well, there's just some things that you can tell if the jobs are getting done or not. Like, are the tasks getting finished? Are they on time? Are the deliverables there? Like, we can talk about metrics all day long, but I don't know, isn't there just a feel as well? Sometimes you just feel that someone is doing a job or isn't doing a job. I don't know. This is where I have the experts in the seats.
You do.
To kind of defer to.
And Elizabeth, you work very closely with Al, so I would love to just hear your perspective on this.
Yeah, I think it's all about having, you know, I loved how Amanda explained, like, the really clear outcomes and goals that went from the corporate level, department, all the way down, and everyone's rowing in the right direction. To me, it's about really clear outcomes by role and having that regular conversation on if you're hitting it and how to hit it and how to remove obstacles out of the way to allow people to hit it, right? And I really believe that it's about setting those right items on a scorecard to help people perform. And by the way, as Alan Robin, you know, for me, outcomes are not just the measurable KPIs, but also the core values, right? There's more than just, you know, I've done this task or I've hit this sales goal. It's about the DNA of the organization as well. That's important performance. But to me, it really is not about seeing you do the work. It's here's how I know it's done, because you're hitting these key objectives that are important to this role, which is important to our business.
And Karis, you always bring a different lens to this.
I was just thinking back to the very early days of my career working in the defense space around training and simulation. And we were training militaries around the world using virtual technology. Of course, we weren't interfacing with our clients. It was all digital. But one of the things that I learned that was really fascinating when you are training people is how they learn, how they produce work. And as we're talking about this, what comes to mind is the office isn't a destination. It's actually a teammate in how we are working. And so at Vetster, I had a number of people coming back off the pandemic that were so pleased to be in the office. They need and like structure in their day. They like a destination. It makes them feel like now mentally I'm ready for work. They liked to have that camaraderie at home, or maybe a little peace and quiet if they had little ones running around. It worked for them. It worked for how they processed information. It worked for how they communicated. It gave them the support and environment that they needed. For others, working from home was providing that structure. Still others were thinking about, when do you come into the office so that you can collaborate? I want to be able to build a relationship with you. When I was at Innerspace, it was the early days of the pandemic. So of course, everyone was adjusting. We were all at home, mostly engineers who were working at odd hours. But one of the things that we really felt we lost as a result of not having an office was checking in with people just as human beings. It wasn't so much about trust. It was about being able to say to someone, are you okay? It is very easy to show up on a screen like this and fake it for an hour in your weekly meeting that everything is okay in your life. And yes, while I was saying that work is an exchange for money and work product, which it is in this context of making a decision of where you're going to work, there is an element of trust, of human connection that is also provided. That's where your culture, that's where your values are coming in. And so I remember in particular, there was somebody who, you know, we just had spidey senses. I think this person is struggling through the pandemic. They live on their own. They don't have a huge social network. They were new to Toronto. How do we connect in with them? Very easy to fake it online for 1 or 2 hours a week, you know, where we're seeing you in person on a walk. hey, I don't think your mental health is okay. What's going on? And come to find out, they were dealing with a lot personally in their family. Okay, hey, how can I support you? How can I be here for you? That does come in person far more than it will ever come online. And so I think we need to start thinking about the office as this other teammate that has a role to play in the relationship that we have, both between each other, but also in the work that we're doing.
Karis, you reminded me of a story that was actually quite sad going through the pandemic. And obviously, I won't name any names, but we had a client who was in office. It was a fun office. It was a very young demographic. They hired people who had just come to Canada. So you can imagine you come to Canada, that's your whole social network in your office. And that was taken away in a heartbeat, right? When COVID, and sent home. And this particular young lady felt like she lost everything. She lost her social connection. She's sitting in her little apartment. And it was very easy, as you pointed out, to show up on screen and fake it. And she ended up taking her life.
Oh, my
goodness. And it was such a heart-wrenching story. And of course, you know, me as the broker, I'm thinking with the HR people that I'm working with, like, well, what could we have done differently? What supports? And thankfully, since then, there has been a lot of development on the mental health space and support that people have, especially remote access to. But you're absolutely right that these are the conversations that we need to have. And I think this is really important. Amanda, I'd love to get your lens on this as well.
I mean, when I think about performance and I think about the office, I don't know. It's right now, I'm so in awe, Karis, of you saying we have to think of the office as another teammate, because I've never considered it that way. And it's sort of changing now, I think, what I would have said, but just that I go back to thinking about, we have to be the ones to say what we want people to get out of being together and what we want to get out of people having the flexibility to be with their lives. And I don't think I have too much more to add other than I really go back to this idea of So because I'm an artist, first, HR, second, but I go back to when you have a concept and you know you have a huge installation or a conceptual piece that you have it in your mind. If you just throw it together and put it in the gallery, you know how sometimes you go see fine art and you walk in and you're like, whoa, I don't even understand what I'm looking at. Now, for some people, that might create a moment of awe or like curiosity, but a lot of times people would tell me, I would go look at conceptual or contemporary art and I'm like, I don't get it. You know, I don't get it. And so as an artist, what I really kind of found over my career, 15 years making these, you know, sort of transformative art pieces, is that the first thing I had to do was really spend some time saying, what is it that I want people to see, feel, think, experience? Not just what's my concept, but what do I want people to come into? What is the space I'm creating? What's the feeling? What's the scent? Really start to articulate that so that it didn't become, I put a bunch of stuff from inside my head out there and I hope you get it. And I think performance, it tends to look like that sometimes, like, well, we're just going to do these things. But I think if we could really start to move that into, what do we actually think success is? What does it feel like? What does it look like? What are we doing? It's not a task list, totally. There are things we got to get done, but it's more than that. I think that's the challenging part. It's actually a really interesting part, too, about getting people really engaged and aligned with what the business needs, how they're interacting with the team, what ownership looks like, what outcomes look like, what good looks like. I mean, ad nauseum. My team probably wants to murder me because I'm always like, what does good look like? But I can't help it because it's really different. What each person is thinking good looks like, even if you give them a goal, you'd be amazed. You would be amazed how different that is in our mind. So we have to just kind of go back to that idea of, like, know what we're trying to create. But how does it all work? What does it actually feel like when we're doing it? And kind of go from there, like be a little less prescriptive and a little more fluid and kind of interested and curious and kind of intentional.
Yeah, I want to swing back to what Kara said, because she put it in a way that I probably wouldn't have put it, but I think I can totally relate to what she is saying. When Kirstie said the office is like a destination and a teammate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have struggled with this whole idea for so many times. And one of the things that I think I really struggle with is the name. Like, it's return to RTO, return to office.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone in their right mind wants to go back to work for the office. No one's in love with the walls, the paint on the walls, or the sound of the computer on your desk, or the scratched commercial flooring. Like, no one loves the office. To me, it is kind of what you said, Karis. It's a place where you can be around people as opposed to being stuck in your little apartment building or whatever, wherever your workspace is at home and working there alone. That's what's important, is just kind of being with the people. And you said something interesting, because listen, people would probably, Robin or anyone else would probably walk up to my office and the door is kind of half closed sometimes and I got my head down.
I just barge in.
Sure. But people could validly say, well, wait a second, Alec, what's the value of being in the office? Like, you're just sitting in with, like, that doesn't make sense. Here's what's important for me. And I thought maybe we'd dive into this when we get to culture, but I know we're kind of getting to the end of this episode. It could be 5, 10, 15 minutes when I walk down for a coffee, I go by someone else's office, someone comes in my office, and we're talking about something. Doesn't matter what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Those 15 minutes out trump the rest of the day. So when those 15 minutes don't happen because I'm sitting at home, Robin, you kind of joked about this at the beginning. Your goal, ladies, is to convince Al that we can be like completely remote. Honestly, and I say this with 100% honesty, when that day happens, I'm not here anymore. If that's that important for me, I can't believe there aren't other people that feel the same way. So when we talk about, you know, people being remote, again, I go back to, I understand wanting to be at home for your kids and people, because I've been there. I get that. But I think what a lot of people forget is, and I keep reading over and over again, there's a loneliness epidemic out there. And to me, that is one of the ways, and you talked about people badging in for a coffee or coming in for lunch. And I guess my question would be, what's wrong with that?
Right.
Like, what if you do just come in for lunch
mm-hmm.
and you talk to people? You're sitting for 30 minutes or 60 minutes and you're talking to people and then you go back home. What's wrong with that?
I think you raise a really good point, because if you look at, Microsoft has completely revamped its Seattle Redmond campus, and they did so, the design of that campus is exactly what you're talking about. It's come, have a coffee, collaborate, you know, be more socially connected rather than be in a cubicle. FreshBooks CEO Mike McDermott did the same thing. The kitchen, which was fully stocked and had the most cereal I've ever seen in my life, was center to the building. And it was designed in such a way that any cross-pollination between teams had to go through this central hub. Yep. It was very intentional and thoughtful. But again, exactly what you say, Al, is I think what Elizabeth and Amanda and I are also saying, which is you have to then decide that that is okay. And unfortunately, the mass media message that we're getting from corporations, most notably the banks post-pandemic, has not been, it is okay to come in and collaborate and then go home. Uh-huh. It has been, I want you there from 9 until 5, yeah, at minimum 4 days a week. And it feels punitive and worse once the employee gets there. They're not being supported with actual desk space that supports the way in which the modern world is working now. If a CEO were to say, I believe that collaboration, water cooler conversation, happy accidents, and a strong relationship between teams is what will propel us forward on our tasks. And therefore, 2 days a week, I want different teams to come in and collaborate. That's when I want you to do your brainstorming. Hey, I do want us to have coffee and team lunches. And that's when we're going to do our weekly meeting so we can ask questions in person.
Yeah.
I haven't heard a single company say that that is what return to office means to them. And so I think, Al, basically, you should write everyone's policy.
Yeah, right.
Because it sounds like you've got it nailed.
It should be called return to togetherness, return to coffee.
Exactly.
It should be. Quite honestly, yes, it should be. It shouldn't be return to office. It should be, hey, return to working with people. Yeah, Absolutely.
But to our success, I will say, because I was there when we created the policy on the return to office. And when Robin and Al and I discussed it, we said, what is our goal? And the goal was creating collisions. The goal was collaboration.
Absolutely.
And through that, the policy was made. And the policy was decided that we would have similar days in the office where everyone comes together and we do our huddles, et cetera. And those different things were laid out that would drive to the goal of collisions. I think Al and Robin have done it very well in the organization. Where we see other organizations, and I'll use my husband's as an example, they just need a badge in 3 days a week.
Yeah.
There's no alignment on the team of when that is. So very frequently he goes in and he's the only one in the office. And then he gets on the screen and calls everyone else so he can have their meetings as a team.
Yeah.
That is the opposite of intentional design for that type of purpose, right? So it comes back to that intention. And I think Al's done it in a great way.
Well, you know what, team? What I love about this conversation, I'm finding out from listening to all you brilliant people, there's no silver bullet, right? But there are better questions. And then trust, clarity, accountability, and outcomes have come up again and again. And we're going to continue a part two of this. Regardless of where people sit, I think this is going to be a very valuable conversation for people to listen to. So we are going to come back and we are going to do episode number two. I will say we genuinely love to hear how this is landing for you. Mm-hmm. Once this episode is out, please reach out to us on LinkedIn. Tell us what your organization is wrestling with and what topics you'd like us to explore next. We will be coming back to do episode number two. Amanda, Elizabeth, Karis, and Al, thank you so much for joining us. I learned a ton. To our audience, thank you as always for listening. And remember, success leaves clues. We'll see you next time. Bye, everyone.